Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. When Antonio Esprit was 16, he fatally shot an innocent bystander during a drug turf war near Detroit. He was given a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. But 2 years ago, after he'd spent 3 decades in prison, he was paroled thanks to a series of Supreme Court decisions based on the argument that because their brains were not fully developed at the time of their crimes, juveniles should be given more lenient sentences than adult perpetrators. Samantha Michaels tells his story in an article in Mother Jones magazine called Life After Life, and she joins us now along with Antonio Esprit. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
At the time of the Supreme Court decisions, Samantha, wasn't the U.S. one of the last countries in the world where juveniles could be sentenced to life without parole?
Yeah, I believe that that's true. They certainly, a few years earlier, in 2005, the Supreme Court had outlawed the death penalty for juvenile offenders, and I know that at that time, United States was one of the last countries giving the death penalty to teenagers.
So, No, to finish your thought.
And in 2016, when the Supreme Court made its ruling about mandatory life without parole, there were about 2,800 juvenile lifers all around the country.
That means, by the way, that the people who were convicted as juveniles were likely to die in prison as many as 60, 70, even 80 years later. And aren't many still in prison despite the Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah, that's right. So since the Supreme Court ruling, about 1,700 people have been resentenced, but a lot of them are still in prison. And only about 1 in 7 of all the juvenile lifers from 2016 have gotten out on parole.
Is that because it's left up to each state? You say Michigan's rules are much tougher than Pennsylvania's.
Yeah, exactly. So the Supreme Court basically instructed the states to go back and revisit these juvenile lifer sentences and to resentence them. But the Supreme Court gave a lot of leeway to each state to handle their cases. And so in Michigan, the resentencing process has moved very slowly, and prosecutors have been pretty harsh in terms of the sentences that they're asking for. So they've asked that about 2/3 of the juvenile lifers in the state be resentenced to life without parole. And then if you compare that to some other states, like in Pennsylvania, the process has moved a lot quicker. And far fewer people have been resentenced to life without parole.
Raise the Age legislation went into effect across New York State on October 1st of last year. So we are one of the states that's probably being more considering these things more than others, including raising the lower age of juvenile delinquency from age 7 to age 12. Antonio, do you prefer to be called Antonio or Tony?
Either or, it's fine.
Okay, well, I'll call you Antonio. Weren't you released on the day before your 47th birthday?
Yes.
And tomorrow is the second anniversary of your release.
Yeah. I will officially be off parole this Saturday, which will be April 6th. And I will be celebrating my reentry back into society successfully.
What were the conditions of your parole?
So the conditions of my parole prior to transferring on an interstate compact transfer out here to Phoenix, Arizona, was left up to Michigan's parole probation office, which those conditions consisted of no contact with the victim's family, no contact with any previous folks that I've grown up with that were involved in any illegal activities, no going into any bars or places that where they predominantly serve alcohol. There was also a time curfew in the condition also of not having any contact with law enforcement. If I was to have any contact with law enforcement, I was to immediately report that. And also being subjected to urine drops at any call throughout the month, and a monthly or on-call reporting to the probation officer, and also having my home open to home inspection by the parole officer.
So you're free of all of that on this coming Saturday.
Yes, yes.
Now, how prepared were you for living in a world that's changed a lot of the 31 years that you'd been in prison?
Well, you can never mentally conceptualize what the reality of society as it has evolved and advanced throughout the decades. You could never really come to understand what that would be like through imagination, maybe, but the actuality of it, no, physically, no. And so the preparing of it is just, it's just a concept.
Well, when you left the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility on April 6, 2017, I gather you went to a restaurant and ordered French toast, and that was the first time in many years that you could actually cut food with a knife and a fork?
Absolutely, yes, because in the prison system, in Michigan's prison system, you allowed a plastic spork, which operates and serves as all of the things in which you can't use, which is a fork, which is a knife and a spoon. And so you have to use that spork to operate as though it is those three utensils.
Had you been in the same prison all that time, an adult facility?
No, I've been through numerous of Michigan's prisons throughout the extent of my incarceration. I was able to, at those facilities, stay between anywhere from a year to maybe 2 years prior to being moved to another facility.
And why did they keep on moving you?
Well, it's at the discretion of the administration. It doesn't necessarily have to refer to a disciplinary problem or a management problem. It can be the correctional officer or the administration just up and decide to move you. They don't have to have a reason. Their reason for transferring prisoners is usually tied up under bed space. And they'll say, we needed this bed, and so we'll transfer you, and we chose you, and, we don't have to explain why other than that.
Now, we mentioned that you hadn't used a knife and fork. You hadn't ever used a cell phone. They didn't allow you to use a cell phone?
No, so cell phones in prisons are contraband, and you rely upon using the phones, which are a vendor that's contracted for prisoners to use, and you have to prepay to be able to prepay. It's filling out a disbursement, adding money, adding funds from your account onto the vendor who is in control of the phone systems. account in order to use the phone to talk and speak with either your family members, friends, or in some cases your attorney or any other business that you have to have a need to use the phone for.
So after you left Michigan, you went to Arizona and you enrolled at Arizona State University. What are you majoring in?
Yes. So coming out here to Phoenix, Arizona, I was able to get enrolled with the help of my cousin, Dr. Marlon M. Bailey, and other supportive colleagues of Arizona State University to get enrolled into Arizona State University, first online. And after being online for a year, I was able to physically begin to start classes, which was actually last semester, last year. And my major is Justice Studies, and I am in the School of Social Transformations.
Samantha, I understand that at the time of the Supreme Court rulings, more than 70% of juvenile lifers were people of color and 60% were African American. Have any studies been done to ascertain whether white juveniles who have committed similar crimes were likely to be given lesser sentences?
Yeah, so the studies that have been done on this do show that generally African Americans are much more likely to be given juvenile life without parole sentences. And actually, since the Supreme Court rulings, the racial gap has gotten a lot worse. So in 2016, about 60% of the juvenile lifers were African American. And since then, about 72% of people juveniles sentenced to life without parole have been African American. So it's getting worse.
And that's surprising because many people who were locked up earlier, like in the 1990s, were also they were part of the super predator scare. One of the reasons the prosecutors could depict these juveniles as adults. So what's happening today? Nobody's talking about super predators.
Yeah, so the issue today is that so the Supreme Court rulings basically outlawed mandatory life without parole for juveniles. So this is situations where the judge has no choice in the sentencing. It's an automatic sentence for the crime of murder often. And so now, if a teenager is going to get life without parole, it has to be a discretionary sentence where the judge has a choice to offer a different kind of punishment. And so the advocates who I spoke with said that basically what's happening is that judges now have discretion, and so racial bias just continues to play a role, and they use their discretion to disproportionately punish kids of color.
Antonio, Samantha wrote in her article about someone who volunteers at a nearby women's prison who wanted your advice on how to support an inmate named Tasha Finley. She's about to be released after spending more than two decades in prison for a murder she committed as a teen. And she was to be sent to a halfway house. You weren't. But what was your advice to her?
So prior to Ms. Tasha Finley being released, it was mainly about communicating with those folks who was involved with the process of helping her to get out, what it all would mean for her to return back to society and have resources available to her from family to community to being able to travel. And to help her in the transitioning from prison to society and allowing her to be able to understand what that means. So my consultation with those folks who helped her and her immediate family members prior to Ms. Tasha Finley arriving, we held those type of talks. Currently, Ms. Tasha Finley is successfully released and has been with us out here working a good job for over a year. and we are helping her to get enrolled into Arizona State University, where she would be majoring in graphic design arts at the Herbinger Institute at ASU. And so she, her story of as a woman, as a black woman, being in the system as a young age and returning back out to society and the success of it is an example of how someone can, after spending decades in prison, can reintegrate back to society and live a successful life and make those contributions back to society that are not dangerous, but are beneficial and helpful by her being an example, a law-abiding citizen, and doing those things that that defies the odds. One of the things I did want to weigh in on is that a part of the work that I do out here in Arizona is I consult with several different grassroots organizations. One is a Cohoots, who's a lobbyist firm. Another one is Arizona Justice Project, which is an innocence project, an American Friends Service Committee of Tucson, Arizona. And we advocate for the changes of the laws currently in place that Arizona has against the juveniles, where the prosecutors out here want to continue to hold the ability to sentence juveniles to the sentence of natural life in prison without the possibility of parole as a punishment that would measure the particular crime or crimes that was committed. While we do have legislators who also in support of that, who are unwilling to waver on their position, our conversations have been in trying to show people like Ms. Tasha Finley and people like myself, who's here in this state, and others who can successfully live a successful life if given the opportunity and chance to parole back out here into society. So the fight, you know, beyond the conversation is trying to get legislators and the prosecutor out here in Arizona to understand that the type of sentencing and the type of time that has been already served should now be reversed and be placed into a process where heavy consideration should be given, you know, in light of such examples where in one point you didn't have Ms. Tasha Finley as an example and you didn't have me as an example, nor do you have other folks out here who have been successful as examples. So the more examples that we can show to prosecutors who want to hold draconian decisions in positions and legislators who want to hold draconian decisions in political positions, the better it is to help, you know, those young folks who are still incarcerated to receive in a second chance.
I'm speaking with Antonio Esprit, who is the subject of an article in Mother Jones magazine called Life After Life, written by Samantha Michaels, who is also with us on today's Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Did people wonder why someone your age was just entering college?
You know, it's funny that you say that. While I do look kind of young.
You're still 47, 49 years old now.
It's not until I reveal if my instructor or professor who knows about my story wants to share it with the class. It's not until I reveal it to the students who are like 19, 20 years of age, some as young as 18, that they, you know, turn and look in shock and awe. They would have never imagined, because there's a stigma that goes with someone who is in prison or who has served time, or what someone should look like, the physical features, and the demeanor, the verbal or the mental demeanor that follows someone that that stigma. And so because I don't exemplify those things, you know, they're always shocked and it's always awe and they're very surprised. And they always tell me, you know, you do not look like someone who serves that amount of time in prison, or you do not sound like someone who's been in prison.
Samantha, the initial Supreme Court ruling drew from new research into brain development that showed teens are more impulsive than adults and more influenced by peer pressure. So they should be judged differently. Then you have the other side of that coin going even further. Human Rights Watch has been trying to convince the justice system to release the really elderly, the 70, 80, 90-year-old people who are still in prison without any opportunity for parole, because the recidivism rate is at zero for people like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point that people's tendency to commit crime, it's highest, you know, when they're a teenager and in their early 20s. But after that point, people tend to age out of crime. As their brain continues to develop in the late 20s and early 30s, people become much less likely to commit crimes. I saw one study that was saying that for all very serious juvenile offenders, fewer than 10% of them will go on to be chronic adult offenders. And you have to keep in mind that a lot of the juvenile lifers in this country who were sentenced in the 1990s are, you know, now in their 40s. And so their odds of recidivating have gone way down simply because of their age.
Antonio, what was life like on the west side of Detroit when you were growing up? You were living with your two half-brothers, your mother and a stepfather. Was that a happy family?
It was, in terms of the relationship with my siblings, it was a very beautiful relationship and experience in terms of living in the household with my stepfather. It was a very dysfunctional relationship upon the time that my stepfather began to abuse drugs, and the type of things in which he brought into the home, which was, you know, violence, abusing my mother, abusing us as his children, his stepchildren. And, you know, upon my mother divorcing my stepfather and my mother turning to alcohol and prescription drugs, the abuse in which she began to subject inside of the household, it was, you know, very dysfunctional as well. So growing up inside of that dysfunction, there was never a way in which I could mature or nor be able to learn the things that were nurturing that a child should be able to receive that would enable that child to, you know, have a healthy and happy life.
You're obviously an intelligent person, but you failed seventh grade three times. And then you dropped out of school?
Yeah, yeah. So the circumstances as a young boy, as a young teenager, between skipping school, between in and out of the youth home, and of course, bad performance when in school, not doing homework, led to me not being able to pass from grade to grade. So that's how those things happen.
So what were you doing at the time of that fateful event, that Tuesday night in 1987, that led to your being given a life sentence?
So turning to the streets and turning to people who live within the neighborhood who understood what was going on inside of my house, the dysfunctions, who offered, you know, a child warm heat when there was no heat in my house, something to eat when there was no food in the refrigerator, love and affection and attention in which I wasn't receiving. Being offered those things came with the cost, in which I, as a young child, readily just participated in, which was, you know, drugs and drug trafficking. And that led, and I followed that because of me looking and searching for guidance and the image and, you know, some sort of attention that I just wasn't getting in the home.
So you were hanging out with some older friends from a Detroit gang called Pony Down, and they went to Ypsilanti near Detroit to sell cocaine. But how did that lead to a turf war that included the use of an Uzi submachine gun?
So traveling to Ypsilanti and traveling from Detroit to Ypsilanti, in those drug areas, you have drug dealers, and those drug dealers, they want to sell their product and only want their product to be sold. And you have rivalries where they don't want you around. You're from one city, they're from that city. They don't want your drugs being sold. It's like you're taking money from their pocket. And so the attitude of who should rule this particular neighborhood or who should rule this particular market that's created to sell drugs, have the most customers, make the most money, that attitude, which, you know, can lead to altercations, lead to fights and escalations and, you know, violence and shootings and on and on.
Were you aware that you had shot and killed Emmanuel Billups?
I wasn't aware of who I shot and killed.
You'd also been shot.
Yes. So as a 16-year-old boy, I shot. Later that evening, I was shot at a house where I was shot in the forehead and I was shot in the finger. And... you know, I still wasn't aware of what had happened. It wasn't until I was actually in custody and I was actually, I could actually read about what was going on or what had happened, all of the dynamics that took place, that I understood, you know, who had died from it and how much damage was done as a result of it.
And they decided to try you as an adult, even though you were 16 years old?
So because the case happened in 1987, Michigan lawmakers had already agreed to change the waiver process for the beginning of the year of 1988, which it would go into effect in January. The juvenile judge, probate court judge, decided because of the case happened in 1987, he would allow me to go through the phase one and phase two hearings within the probate court. And so while the prosecutor objected to that, the probate court judge still had jurisdiction at that time. And so this was prior to the automatic waiver later that Michigan lawmakers began to enforce, which took total jurisdiction from the judge and gave all of the jurisdiction to the prosecutor to be able to step into the courtroom and say, this is the process by which we will try this young person. So I did go through the waiver procedure phases one and two. I was waived to stand trial as an adult, and so I had that opportunity.
We are back with Samantha Michaels, who has written an article called Life After Life in Mother Jones magazine. And we're talking with the subject of that article, Antonio Esprit. And Samantha, I want to get into the details of what's happened since the Supreme Court started making these decisions. But can I spend just a little more time with Tony talking about what happened with him, how he changed?
Yeah, definitely.
You got into a lot of trouble during your early prison years. How many times were you sent to solitary?
I can't say by number, but I would just say several times. My first 5 years incarcerated was very, very, as a young person, you know, still trying to figure out what's going on. So it's very bad and very, very rough. You still, as a 17-year-old child inside of the Department of Corrections, you don't know how to figure out what that is and what it means.
Were most of the other inmates were adults?
Most of them were adults, and like I said, I was looking for the word, and the word is very defiant. You still carry that defiant mentality and attitude around. You have to now fit into a process and environment where there's other like-minded by the hundreds, and you have to defend yourself because there's predators. There's the environment creates situations where you have to fight, fend off yourself. And if you have a very weak or emotional position about yourself, some young people turn to suicide. And so the amount of violence and negativity that existed within the prison system that I entered reminded me of the streets.
And you say that it all changed by your mid-20s because you were tired of getting in trouble and being put into solitary.
Yes. So after, constantly being told, this is what to do, I didn't think for myself. I didn't know how to think for myself. At the end of the day, I always was the one in trouble. And I got fed up. I wanted to learn how to think for myself. I wanted to learn and understand what it is that I needed to do. I made my mind up. And after getting out of solitary confinement one day, I got involved in a prison program just to see what it was about. And I started going to other programs. It was one in particular that helped me understand. There was a program that a prisoner who was dressed just like me, who was serving time just like me, but he was an older prisoner. He was running the program, and it dealt with issues that related to me understanding myself and helping me to understand how to think and how to get through the time that I was doing.
So you're going through a kind of therapy, in effect.
Yes. Yeah.
But when you went to prison in 1988, you were only reading at a middle school level. You dropped out of school.
Yes.
How do you get to the point where you can start being able to read Supreme Court rulings and things like that?
From continuing to go to programs, I had decided to turn the way I think and respond while in prison around. So I began to seek and search out for correspondence courses through the mail, and I began to read certain books, and of course, conversations with prisoners like the older prisoners who were trying to teach younger people like me how to improve their self, their attitude. And so it was through those ways, those methods, those techniques that helped me to learn how to evolve, learn how to think, learn how to read, learn how to write. So it was the help of not just one particular thing or person, but an admixture of all things.
So you got your GED certificate, and then you enrolled in some college classes.
Yes.
In effect, self-educating. Samantha, in 2010, the Supreme Court decided that life without parole sentences for teenagers who committed non-homicide crimes violated the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. But that wouldn't have applied to Antonio. In 2012, the justices decided in Miller versus Alabama that even if a juvenile was convicted of homicide, a judge had to consider factors such as the teenager's maturity level and home environment when handing down a punishment. So that might have actually affected the way Antonio's trial had been conducted.
Right, exactly. Yeah, in 2012, the justices outlawed mandatory life without parole.
So does that mean that mandatory
that Tony had received?
So does that mean that the sentences like he received are now unconstitutional?
Exactly, yeah. They violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment.
So why wasn't Tony given parole, or at least given some kind of a retrial following the Supreme Court's decision?
Well, so for a few years after that 2012 decision, there was disagreement about whether that decision would apply retroactively. It was unclear if that decision would apply to the 2,800 people like Tony who were already serving their sentences. In 2016, the justices decided that it was retroactive, that it would apply to them. And so at that point, the justices said that all of those people, including Antonio, should have a chance to be resentenced. And so after that point, Antonio was resentenced, and ultimately he was able to get parole. Although in Michigan, at least, you know, he was one of the lucky ones because the state has moved pretty slowly to resentence most of the other juvenile lifers there.
It would have been different if he had been living in Pennsylvania or New York, for that matter.
Yeah, it might have been even faster if he had been living in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania also had a huge population of juvenile lifers, more than 500 of them, which was the biggest population of juvenile lifers in 2016. But that state has moved a lot faster to resentence juvenile lifers. At this point, I think they've resentenced about 400 of them, and more than 150 of them have gotten out of prison on parole. And far fewer of them have been resentenced to life without parole.
Isn't there some irony in the fact that the case that where the judges decided to retroactively apply the decision to people who'd already been sentenced was the Henry Montgomery case, who he was 17 when he killed a white sheriff's deputy in Louisiana in 1963, and there was a lot of racial tension at the time. He is still in prison, isn't he? 72 years old, and he still isn't free?
Yeah, that's right. So Henry Montgomery won his Supreme Court case. They decided that it should be retroactive and that juvenile lifers should be resentenced. And he's currently at Angola Prison in Louisiana, so he was resentenced. And in 2018, he went in front of the parole board and he asked for parole. And the parole board turned him down. They said that he hadn't participated in enough educational classes in prison, which was disappointing because during the first three decades that he was at that prison, the prison actually did not allow juvenile lifers to participate in educational programs. And then after that point, he was deemed ineligible to get his GED. So he hadn't really been given very much of an opportunity. But the parole board rejected him and said that he would have to wait. Actually, he's going to go in front of the parole board again this month, so he may get a chance to get out.
Now, you point out that about a third of juvenile lifers nationally say they've been denied access to prison educational programs. What is the rationale for not letting these people educate themselves? Obviously, it turned Antonio around.
Yeah, exactly. I think the issue is that a lot of prisons are very under-resourced, and so there's a shortage of educational programs, and there's often a very long wait list to get into these programs. And so juvenile lifers, because the idea is that they'll be in prison for the rest of their lives, they're often either put at the back of the wait list or they're just completely deemed ineligible.
The justice who decided in the Montgomery case was Anthony Kennedy, who's no longer on the court. You almost have to wonder whether a Brett Kavanaugh court would have decided the same way.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay.
But prosecutors still have discretion, and you point out that they continue to argue against parole. Is that why about 1 in 7 of the juvenile lifers locked up in 2016? Only 1 in 7 have been freed?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on which state you're in. As we've talked about, different states are handling it different ways. In some states, like in Michigan, a lot of the prosecutors are requesting that people be resentenced to life without parole. They say that these crimes were so heinous that even now these people should not be given a chance at parole. Another thing is that a lot of people have been resentenced. About 1,700 people have been resentenced to shorter sentences that will eventually allow parole, but just not yet. And so these people will have to serve many more years in prison before they're able to go before the parole board.
Antonio, Michigan didn't have problems with you studying. Did they encourage you to take classes?
So the thing is, I just want to also weigh in on that comment about a Brett Kavanaugh's court. You know, we did have the Chief Justice Roberts vote in the Montgomery versus Louisiana, and it was also in his comments in support of the retroactivity. So I just wanted to bring that in,
sure.
This court
still might have voted the same way, but just maybe with a slimmer majority.
Yeah, exactly. In favor, of course. But the question about, in terms of Michigan's position on prisoners educating themselves is a position that they take in opposition. And the reason they take that in opposition is because the more educated you become as a prisoner, the more what they deem a security threat you become. A security threat you become deemed as because of the fact that you can educate other prisoners, you can teach other prisoners how to file grievances, you can yourself file civil litigation, and you can question policy and procedures. And so once you become more educated, it becomes a problem to them. Because the Department of Corrections, they do not want prisoners to be in a position to disturb the operating procedures or process day to day as it occurs.
So keep them dumb and docile.
Exactly.
That's kind of shocking, isn't it? You would have thought that they would understand that as people become more educated, they're less likely to engage in criminal activities. At least the uneducated kids who have come into the prison system.
Yeah, it is if the department controls the way in which education is being delivered, then it's acceptable. But if it is not within their means to control the education as it comes in, then that information now becomes up under suspicion. And so, you know, you cannot successfully look at rehabilitation through the lenses of corrections when a prisoner pursues the means to educate or self-rehabilitate themselves outside of the control of corrections.
Samantha, you note that only about 10% of serious juvenile offenders become chronic adult offenders, and of the 150-plus juvenile lifers who were freed in Pennsylvania in recent years, not a single one has reoffended. Are you there? Okay, well, I think we may have lost Samantha. We'll try to get her, although we only have a few minutes to go, but I do want to ask her about some related matters. Samantha, are you there? Okay. Could you try to get her again? Meanwhile, Antonio, you say that the part of your parole prevented you from being able to get in touch with the family of the man that you killed, Emmanuel Billups. I'm assuming you would have apologized to them and told them how sorry you were that you had done what you did.
So I did have an opportunity and chance through my lead attorney and through a mitigation specialist who does mitigation processing and to reach out to both my victim's mother and daughter. And to be able to actually have a phone call while in prison with my victim's daughter. I like to call her Shanetta. You know, I don't like to refer to her as, you know, a victim or nothing like that. So with Shanetta. And Shanetta and I spoke. Shanetta was able to forgive me. I was able to tell Shanetta that I'm sorry for what happened, and we were able to come to an understanding and move forward from there. So I was able to gain the support of both Shanetta and her mom through affidavits in support of my resentencing, seeing the parole board and my release.
Samantha, I'm glad you're back. There are two cases. We don't have a lot of time, but there are two cases that I find rather shocking, and maybe you could tell us about them. One is the Kevin Boyd case, and the other is the Cyntoia Brown case. Kevin Boyd didn't even commit the murder. His mother committed the murder, and yet he's he's sentenced to life without parole and remains in prison?
Yeah, Kevin's story is really sad. He was a teenager growing up in Michigan, and his parents were going through a really rough divorce. And one day his mom came over and told Kevin that she wanted to kill his dad, and she asked Kevin if he would hand over the keys to his dad's apartment. And so Kevin, 16 years old, gave her the keys. And the next day, the dad was dead with a bunch of stab wounds. And the mom pleaded guilty, confessed to the crime, and was sentenced to life without parole. And Kevin received the same sentence, even though a jury never determined whether or not he had actually participated in the stabbing.
They saw him as an accessory?
Yeah, well, it just wasn't clear. But in either case, he had handed over the keys, so he had helped the mother kill the father.
And the prosecutor is still fighting freeing him.
Yeah, so after the Supreme Court decision, the prosecutor asked that he be resentenced to life without parole, and he hasn't been resentenced yet. The case was stalled.
And then, although Miller versus Alabama outlawed mandatory life without parole terms for juveniles, it didn't do much for Cyntoia Brown, who killed a middle-aged man when she was 16 after he brought her to his Tennessee home for sex.
Right. So
you would have thought the judge would have seen that she was protecting herself.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really tragic case. The problem with that case was that Cyntoia received a sentence of mandatory life in prison with the possibility of parole. And so she argued that this was unconstitutional, but the courts in Tennessee, where she's from, said that the sentence was still okay because she did have the option of parole, even though she wouldn't be able to come up before the parole board for about half a century. So she would spend most of her life in prison. So it was a really tragic case. And actually, even though the courts did not side with her, in January, the governor of Tennessee granted her clemency. And so that means that in August, she'll be able to leave prison. But there are still a lot of other people in Tennessee who are serving similar sentences who won't get that kind of help.
A federal judge ruled her mandatory life sentence was constitutional.
Exactly. Constitutional because she was given the option of parole, even though parole would not be available for about half a century.
And as you pointed out earlier, nationally, black teens are much more likely than white teens to receive these kinds of sentences. Cyntoia Brown, obviously African-American. And you also pointed out that the situation's actually gotten more racially divisive since the Supreme Court decisions. Why does anybody have a theory as to why that is?
Well, I think it's just, now mandatory life without parole is unconstitutional. And so if judges want to give these sentences to teenagers, it's discretionary. They have a choice. And so because it's discretionary and because so much of our criminal justice system is racially biased against people of color, judges are using their discretion to disproportionately punish kids of color.
Have you heard from people in similar situations since you began publishing articles about this? The one in the current Mother Jones is the second one you've written about Antonio.
I've kept in touch with Antonio. I've kept in touch with Kevin. I'm not currently in touch with any juvenile lifers, but do continue to send messages to Kevin, who's still in prison, Kevin Boyd.
And Antonio, are you helping other people make adjustments to life outside of prison?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm currently mentoring two women out here in Phoenix who have had experience in the Department of Corrections. They're both doing very, very well. I also volunteer at a youth detention center out here in Florence, Arizona, speaking to young kids from the ages of 13 to 17. I also volunteer when my time permits to a high school, speaking with young kids in a classroom. And I do a lot of consultation work with different attorneys around the issue of trying to help their clients who are still up under the sentence of natural life without parole, and trying to work with different attorneys out here who are working with legislators to get them to change their positions, to change the sentence structure that's currently in place that prevents juveniles out here in Arizona from being resentenced. Or even entering into see the parole process. One thing I think deserves more attention to is that the United States Supreme Court of America evolved the Eighth Amendment. In the fight against the states more so political, who still holds the position of not wanting to come in compliance, the federal Eighth Amendment, although it has evolved, the justices separated young people from adults. And given the young people a class unto themselves to be able to be protected up under the Eighth Amendment on cruel and unusual punishment, so you wouldn't have to be subjected to it. However, the judges in the state courts, speaking namely of them, have looked at the ruling in Miller versus Alabama, and because language didn't say banned in terms of those who committed the act or committed the crime, or they wouldn't, the United States Supreme Court of America justices wouldn't clearly outline what they meant in certain references, judges have taken it upon themselves to use the mitigating factors and say, well, personally, well, I think you could have overcame this, or you should have. I grew up in the same neighborhood. So you have instances where judges are personalizing the mitigating factors that you find that courts should follow in Miller versus Alabama, which does not fairly give, namely, young black men and some women, the opportunity to receive relief up under the case. And when you have that type of process in place by both judge and prosecutor, it does not say to the young person that you are a young person. It still continues to say that you are an adult and you should be looked at and continue to be tried as an adult. So it's still, the states still defy the United States Supreme Court ruling and the Eighth Amendment on cruel and unusual punishment.
And I have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. Thank you both so much for being on our show, Antonio Esprit and Samantha Michaels, who has written an article called Life After Life in Mother Jones magazine. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Leonard Lopez at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopez at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.